Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over 5 recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on. But either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top 5 countdown for the week. At number 5, we have the U.S.'s plans to send over 200 more boots on the ground to Iraq under the pretense of fighting Daesh. Ashton Carter made the announcement earlier in the week, also adding that the U.S. will give the Iraqi Kurds $415 million in unspecified aid. On top of that, U.S. troops, while still not being allowed to offensively engage the enemy, will be able to operate a lot closer to the battlefield than ever before, including through their newly permitted use of in-battle Apache attack helicopters. Overall, Carter's announcement means that the number of boots on the ground will jump from the present 3,870 to 4,087, which is certainly a lot more than when Obama promised that there wouldn't be any last year. Looked at in this context, the new role that these troops will have does make them a handy asset in the Iraqi army's liberation struggle against Daesh. But we can't forget about the $415 million to the Kurds. That's a lot of money anywhere, but especially in this part of the world. And it's a given that it will be used to buffer up the Kurdish regional government's military and administrative capabilities. The whole point of this is to solidify the creation of a state within a state, to even more deeply institutionalize the de facto independence of the Kurdish regional government than it already is. And let's remind ourselves that their leader, Barzani, said that he plans on holding an independence referendum by the end of the year. In essence, the U.S. troops and the almost $500 million being given away to the Kurds will obviously be used in a large capacity to internally partition Iraq via a divide-and-rule format overseen by Washington. U.S. soldiers will be aiding both the Iraqi army and the Peshmerga, and consequently, keeping the two sides from turning against the other after the anti-terrorist conflict ends. It's important to recall that the Kurds captured Kirkuk in the aftermath of the Iraqi army's withdrawal, and that they're dead set on occupying this oil-rich area indefinitely as part of their Kurdistan plans. I have no doubt that this will lead to future post-conflict tension, as the Iraqis possibly seek to liberate their city from Peshmerga occupation after Daesh is defeated. But with U.S. boots on the ground aiding the Kurds in almost $500 million of unspecified aid, helping them to establish concrete military facts on the ground in their zone of occupation, it's going to be pretty difficult. So let's call a spade here, guys. What the U.S. is doing with the Iraqi Kurds is basically the same thing that it wants to do with the Syrian Kurds, which is institutionalize a de facto independent and transnational Kurdistan that would function as a geopolitical Israel and allowing the U.S. to exert unipolar influence smack dab in the center of the Middle East. No matter what one's sympathies are to the Kurds and how much you might appreciate their brave anti-terror resistance, it's impossible at this point to deny that their most well-known leaders, as represented by the PYD and the Kurdish regional government, are being used as the U.S.'s useful idiots, if not outright collaborators. The next one up is the Polish foreign minister's wacky pronouncement that Russia is more of an existential threat to his country than Daesh and the immigrant crisis are. So I just found this to be plain ridiculous, guys. You know, the Polish foreign minister, Witold Waszczykowski, was speaking at the annual GlobSec Security Forum in Bratislava when he said that, and I quote, "By all evidence, Russia's activity is a sort of existential threat because this activity can destroy countries," end quote. Asked by some of the more curious reporters there to comment on how he views Daesh then, he surprised them all when he said that it, and this is yet another quote, "is not an existential threat for Europe," end quote. He also said that the migration crisis isn't one either. My colleague Dmitry Babich wrote a very good piece about this for RT, and you guys should read it if you're interested in some additional commentary on the topic. But what I have to say is that this isn't surprising. It's emblematic of the institutional paranoia that plagues the Polish establishment, which it has of Russia, and this is all centered on their narrow-minded view in which they interpret international relations. For them, historical memory isn't just a memory, it's a present-day obsession. And because of this, Russia is always painted as the big bad wolf. Never mind that the Nazis committed an untold number of atrocities against the Poles. The Warsaw Zeitgeist has always been one of Russophobia ever since the time of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. and seen most unforgettably when the Poles occupied Moscow in the early 1600s. I don't intend to give you guys a history lesson here, but I do encourage you all to explore the truth of where all this anti-Russian hate comes from and just how one-sided the Western reporting on the issue is. Moving along, it's clear that Poland has a lot of self-interest in making the absurd proclamation that it regards Russia as more of an existential threat than Daesh and the immigrant crisis, because there's about to be a NATO summit in Warsaw this summer. Ever since the new Cold War, and actually before it if you were following around then, Poland has been begging for more US and NATO military supplies in order to euphemistically contain Russia. But in reality, this is based on projecting Polish influence via a multilateral mutual defense pact over the formerly occupied territories of modern-day Belarus and western Ukraine, areas which are dear to the Polish psyche as part of their beloved interwar Kresy, or borderlands as they're called in Polish. Poland doesn't really view Russia as an existential threat. I mean, if it did, then those Polish jokes would actually be true, and I'm an ethnic Pole, so I can say that. But it's playing a perception game in seeking to get as much as it can from the US and NATO in furtherance of its geopolitical interests, which, in my opinion, are presently misguided and do more harm than good to Poland's overall real national interest. If only Poland could maximize its geography to be the bridge linking the Russian and German economies, it could benefit so much. But sadly, the elite's hyper-nationalism is sabotaging the country's exciting economic potential. What a shame. Third on our countdown is how the Saudis are threatening the U.S. with de facto economic blackmail if Americans are allowed to sue the kingdom for 9/11. What's happening is that Congress might pass a bill that does just that, and while Obama could realistically veto it, as they're saying he might, the very talk of this law has been enough to send shivers down the Saudi spine. They've been in full-blown panic mode, threatening that they might sell off the $750 billion, yes, that's a billion with a B, in treasury securities and other assets before they could potentially be frozen by American courts. Well, why the guilty reaction, huh? I mean, doesn't this just reek of suspicion that even before the Saudis are allowed to even be taken to court, before a judge has even ruled anything at all, they're fearful that they'll be found guilty and their assets frozen? Could this have anything to do with the concurrent push to declassify 28 pages from Congress's 838-page report on the 9/11 events? Could they contain the smoking gun evidence that would make any judge rule against the Saudis in an instant and hand over whatever the plaintiffs are asking for? I mean, there is no smoking gun just yet, but there might be, and that could explain the frenzied reaction from Riyadh over all this. But my intent isn't to talk on and on about how or why the Saudis might be guilty. I mean, most people already know that most of the 9/11 terrorists were Saudi nationals and had received support from other Saudis, among many other unsavory details that work against the Saudis' purported innocence here. But what I want for you guys to focus on is the context in which this is all occurring. While the U.S. and Saudi Arabia are close, their relations are frayed over the U.S.'s deal with Iran and the oil war, both of which have riled quite a few royals in Riyadh. The Saudi establishment, while still heavily dependent on American military goodwill and strategic collaboration in the Mideast, is seriously thinking about diversifying its partnerships, which explains why Chinese President Xi Jinping visited the kingdom earlier this year and why Saudi Arabia has been talking about potentially purchasing defensive weapon systems from Russia ever since last year. Of course, do not get me wrong. Saudi Arabia is a unipolar and aggressive state, but there is a lot of constructive value that could be added to global stability if it moderates its policies and works closer with the multipolar colossus of Russia and China. I'm surely not getting my hopes up for this, and neither should you, but I'm bringing this all up to put everything into a global strategic context. As much as I personally, in a private, individual capacity, believe that the Saudis were criminally complicit in 9/11 and that they owe the victims and everyone else in the world, especially Syrians, everything that they ask for and more, I objectively see this whole situation as symptomatic of serious strategic differences between the American and Saudi political establishments, which, I must add, are not homogenous, and if taken further along their present trajectory, they could lead to some interesting and unpredictable shifts that radically alter the geopolitical landscape with time. Our runner-up is Netanyahu's defiant statement that Israel will never return the occupied Golan Heights to Syria. He said this while holding Israel's first-ever cabinet meeting in the occupied Syrian lands, obviously for symbolically dramatic effect here. That's the way that Netanyahu typically deals with any situation, and that's with as much bluster as he could muster, which is no different in this case. But you know, Israel isn't just doubling down on its occupation of the Golan Heights for nothing. It sees the territory as being a crucial geostrategic outpost from which it can continue to indefinitely project military influence further afield and deeper into Syria. After all, it's an elevated location that offers the Israeli military prime turf in monitoring the events below, which in this case is the war on Syria. Which, to remind everybody, we see this manifested through Israel's occasional bombing of the country and its medical aid to terrorist groups such as al-Nusra and others. So, despite Tel Aviv always saying that it's neutral in the war, that's just really not the case. I mean, even if Israel didn't do any of these things, it's never been neutral to Syria, especially after it occupied the Golan Heights in 1967. And you know, I'd like to remind everyone that not a single country, not even the U.S., has recognized this unilateral 1981 annexation of the Golan Heights to Israel, which thus makes Israel a total international rogue. Moreover, like I explained to you guys a while back, Israel wants to prolong its illegal occupation of the Syrian Golan Heights because of the oil reserves that were recently discovered there. So, aside from geostrategic and hegemonic considerations, there's also the allure of natural resources, which explains, but by no means whatsoever excuses, Israel's territorial greed. Netanyahu has been promoting his government's ultra-radical position lately, primarily because of these reasons, especially the energy one, and this puts him at public diplomatic odds with the U.S. Vice President Joe Biden earlier this week issued a sharp and piercing rebuke to the Israeli leader when he said that he's leading his government in, and I quote, the wrong direction. U.S. State Department spokesman John Kirby also reiterated that the U.S. position remains unchanged, pointing out that both Democratic and Republican administrations have refused to recognize Israel's unilateral claim to the region. Combined with what Biden had said, this is a pretty symbolic response from the U.S. that shows that it and Israel, just like with the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, have some very serious strategic differences that are now becoming part of a very public and nasty spat. So, it's no secret, guys. We all know Obama and Netanyahu despise each other, despite their statements to the contrary. And there have been many media reports to these ends. But in spite of all of this, the U.S. and Israel still remain each other's number one partners in the world. There is no breaking the lobbying and special interest connection that ties the two together. But what can happen is that this could be weakened by other lobbying and special interest groups seeking the promotion of their own different self-interest. And that, guys, is the very prolonged process that I believe we are witnessing. At our top spot, we've got the simmering regime change crisis in the Republic of Macedonia and why the U.S. is once more targeting the Balkan nation with destabilization. I've been following the story since it first broke almost a year ago, and truth be told, I predicted the contours of the U.S.'s destabilization plan against Macedonia over a year ago when I published my article in Oriental Review about how the future of the Balkans runs through Macedonia. You guys can check it out later on your own if you'd like to get my play-by-play analysis of what's happened, but to cut to the chase, the Republic of Macedonia is the critical geostrategic portion of both Russia and China's multipolar transnational connective infrastructure projects in the Balkans, specifically the now-suspended Balkan Stream Pipeline, officially known as Turkish Stream, and China's Balkan Silk Road, officially the high-speed railroad project that aims to connect the Greek port of Piraeus to Budapest and possibly even onwards to Warsaw, Riga, and St. Petersburg. U.S. wants to stop these projects from being created because they can potentially liberate all of Europe with multipolar influence in the future. So it's stirring up problems inside of Macedonia to squash all of that. To broadly summarize, the NSA illegally wiretapped prominent people in the country for a prolonged period of time, and then it sent doctored recordings to its color revolution proxy in the country, Zoran Zaev, in order to blackmail the government. When this did not work, he selectively released what he aggressively called bombs in order to provoke a color revolution, which was first attempted last May. It was beaten back by patriotic Macedonians who took to the streets to protest the regime change plot. And the security services thankfully stopped an Albanian terrorist cell in Kumanovo from carrying out coordinated anti-government attacks during this important time. In the political aftermath, the EU and the US presided over the Perzino Agreement that called for early elections, and in accordance with this, democratically elected, legitimate, and very popular Prime Minister Nikola Gruevski stepped down prior to the vote's run-up, which was actually pushed back after the opposition said they'd boycott it. Now, President Ivanov pardoned all people affiliated with the political crisis in the country in order to move on. But this was turned into a trigger for preemptively launching the latest destabilization, which was originally going to be launched closer to the 5 June early election date. U.S. Ambassador Jess Bailey is complicit in all of this and is suspected to have pressured the TV channel of the most popular Macedonian host, Milenko Nedeljkovski, to censor former Deputy Interior Minister Natalia Ivcheva's comments on his show, accusing the U.S. of being behind the regime change chaos. What it boiled down to, guys, is that the U.S. wants to turn Skopje into the Balkan Kiev in order to sabotage Russia and China's multipolar projects in the region. But thank God that the Macedonian people have been rallying in support of their country, just like they did last May during the darkest days of the incipient hybrid war attempt against them. They know that if their government is overthrown, not only would their name and entire identity be changed and country possibly quote-unquote federalized and eventually maybe even partitioned between Albania and Bulgaria, they also know that over a million immigrants are expected to crash into Europe and that Zaev's puppet government would cancel the Russian and Chinese projects. Come to think about it, I stand corrected, folks. It's not just the future of the Balkans that runs through Macedonia. It's the future of Europe. So, okay, guys, there you have it. This is the end of this week's episode of Context Countdown. And as I always do, I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for listening to my program. It sincerely means a lot to me. I really appreciate it. And I want to encourage you guys to share my program on social media. So, guys, have a wonderful weekend. Please tune into my program next week and take care. Bye.